Local independent sources of news and information are disappearing around the country. And in Montana, that meant the shuttering of a beloved newspaper.
Everybody got hurt when the Indy was closed, and that's really unfortunate.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, the story of the death and possible resurrection of the Missoula Independent. We'll also talk about medical ethics inside the lab and spend an academic minute with big and small dogs. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. One of the best ways to educate yourself about a community is to read, watch, or listen to their local media. But independent local media outlets are becoming scarce. Employees of Montana's beloved alt-weekly, the Missoula Independent, woke up on a Tuesday ready to put another week's issue to bed and found that they were locked out of their offices. What happened and what's going to happen next? The story's not over. Reporter Melissa Loveridge has the details.
When employees at the Missoula Independent woke up on September 11th, 2018, it was a regular Tuesday. But it didn't stay that way for long. By the afternoon, the small, sleepy city of Missoula was in unrest, but we'll get to that in a minute. That morning, the Missoula Independent, which is an alt-weekly, was suddenly, without warning, shut down. The locks on the building were changed, employees couldn't get into their work emails, and the website for the paper redirected to the local daily. Both are owned by the corporate newspaper chain Lee Enterprises. What happened at the Independent, or the Indy, happens all over the U.S. It's unique in Missoula because of how it happened. On that morning, Erica Fredrickson had just dropped off her daughter at the bus stop. Before heading to work, she had a few things to get together. She's an arts editor at the Independent, where she's worked for a decade. That Tuesday, like a lot of other Tuesdays, was the final push to close out that week's issue.
And then I went back to my apartment and saw that I had an email in my personal account from Lee Enterprises, which was unusual because they would normally send it to my work email. So I opened it, and the subject was it was something to do with the Missoula Independent being closed.
Others who worked at the Missoula Independent didn't check their emails before heading to the office, which was in a weird cabin-like building close to downtown. The door was locked. Someone had taped a sign to it from the inside. It was a more concise version of the email Erica got that morning. The Independent has closed its office and ceased publication.
You know, basically said, don't come to work. You can set up a time to get your stuff. I was so tired that I didn't really realize it was September 11th. I thought maybe this was like a week away or something. I immediately called Derek Brower, who was one of our reporters, and I read him, and I woke him up, and I read him the email, which he had also gotten but hadn't read yet. And he said, "That's today. That's now." And I remember saying, "So it's over?"
I'm Melissa Loveridge, and I want to tell you about the Indy, which is what everyone still calls it. It had a super loyal following. And how all this went down and what's next for the people who worked there, that's been bubbling for a while now here in Missoula. The Indy had a cult following like a miniature version of the Village Voice, only people liked it more. On the morning it shut down, the Indy's website disappeared without a trace. The domain redirected to the daily newspaper, the Missoulian.
And I don't get it. It hurts, and it feels personal that they took it down. I'm not saying that it was, but it sure feels like they were trying to hurt us.
That's Charlie McCorn, who is the calendar editor for the Indy. The Indie Calendar was the go-to for everything worth checking out around town. When you didn't have plans for the weekend, you went to Charlie's Calendar.
With the loss of the digital archives, generations of Montana artists no longer have those clips to promote themselves. They no longer have a way to show people what their art is or what they've done or show their artistic journey.
To really understand what happened at the Missoula Independent, you need the backstory. It started with a mandatory meeting in April 2017. Here's Erica.
There was Mike Gulledge, who was the publisher at the time, and Matt Gibson, who was our owner at the time and who had sold the paper to Lee Enterprises, were there to tell us that this is what had happened and that we were now employees of Lee Enterprises.
While they were in the meeting, the Missoulian published a story about Lee Enterprises acquiring the Indy. The Indy pretty much thought of the Missoulian as its competitor and was basically the only publication in town that would take the Missoulian to task.
It was especially hard when Lee Enterprises bought us because our brand took such a hit. It was really hard to explain to people how we were independent news under a corporation.
The Indy had operated on its own since 1991. Staffers had no idea how being owned by a corporation based all the way in Iowa would affect the image of the paper. So Derek Brower, one of the Independent's three staff reporters, decided to write a story.
The questions were quite obvious, really, and when a corporate daily buys its independent competitor, it's just sort of the logical question to follow about what its intentions are for maintaining that paper, why the sale occurred in the first place.
Derek wrote a story detailing the fall of the Casper, Wyoming Alt Weekly. Lee Enterprises owned the Casper Star Tribune, the daily paper there.
I can't remember what our cover story was going to be that week, but we ditched it and we went for a cover story on Lee Enterprises.
And the reason that I found Casper interesting was because, despite what the owners and publishers were saying about the deal, which is, predictably rosy language, there was quite a bit of uncertainty about what the purchase would mean for the Indy.
The Independent ran an entire package on Lee Enterprises in the name of transparency. Derek said he didn't receive any notable pushback on his story. And for a while after the acquisition, there was no noticeable change. But then
things started to kind of, a good number of staff were brought over to the Missoulian, our graphic designer, our arts director, some staff people. And the first big thing was that they had the Missoulian ad reps were selling ads for both papers, which we did not like.
Felt like we weren't really a part of the conversation. So we wanted to be at the table for that, which is why you unionize.
Derek had brought up the idea of a union before. He and Ariel Lavensure, who ran events for the Indy, got things going for the organizing of the Independent Union.
We ended up having, one-on-one conversations with everyone on staff who wasn't a manager about this, privately over, kind of like these secret coffee meetings.
Those mulling over unionizing knew it wouldn't sit well with the new owners. The worst-case scenarios played out in conversations.
I think I talked to every coworker about that possibility during the organizing campaign, was that Lee could decide to shut the paper down as a result of this.
The former owner of the paper is Matt Gibson. He sold the Indy to Lee Enterprises and then went to work for Lee as management. He's the current executive director of the Montana Newspaper Association. He said the shuttering of the Independent wasn't because of the formation of the union, but financial reasons. I talked to Matt on the phone.
Well, the paper wasn't closed because there was a union. The paper was closed because it was losing a lot of money. The employees made it harder to fix that.
How?
The union resisted substantive efforts to reduce expenses.
Matt bought the Independent in 1997 and owned it for 20 years before he sold it to Lee Enterprises. He said closing the paper wasn't easy.
Everybody got hurt when the Indy was closed, and that's really unfortunate and something that was particularly painful to me. So it was a bad outcome, but I think it was trying to make a go of it with the Missoulian was the
the right thing to do at the right time and gave the independent the best opportunity to persist for the long term. And unfortunately, it just didn't work out.
You know, this happens all the time where when unionization happens, then there's a shutdown. I'm not saying that that's what happened here, but I do feel like we didn't get a chance to really be at the table and talk about solutions. And that's just my opinion on that. I'm sure that Lee Enterprises feels differently.
I think that if we had not unionized, the way the paper ultimately died would have looked different. I think we, perhaps in their eyes, may have forced their hand on this. And they chose to cut their losses.
The Independent shut down less than 6 months after its employees unanimously voted to form a union. Here's Charlie.
Felt like a murder. It felt like someone murdered the Indy. It was a really painful day, and it was a really painful, you know, few months, and maybe so painful for a lot of us there. The more traditional news services don't cover the things that the Indy covered, and it's a real blow to our art scene, our music scene, you know, to the city.
Derek was able to find another job. He moved to Burlington in January.
For me, it was such a big deal in my life, and emotionally as well as professionally. I was grateful to get a chance to continue reporting, but it also came with a certain amount of guilt for myself, and that when I left Missoula, none of my coworkers had found full-time work yet. I have really mixed feelings about leaving Montana. I definitely, you know, wish I could be there with them trying to make something out of the mess that became of the Indy.
You know, we were pretty upset about the closure and felt like, you know, we were going through the same grief process as a lot of other readers were. But we were all noticing during that time the amount of support we were getting. And I think even within the first couple of weeks, I started feeling like, I don't know if this is such a tragedy. It might actually be, you know, a door opening. And I don't know, you know, what that means.
Erica says that she and a few others knew what the next step had to be.
We have to make another paper, and none of us know how to do that because we're all writers and reporters and editors. But we felt this obligation and also this sense of that it was just inevitable.
Not all of the old independent staff is involved in this planning, and nothing is concrete, but it's getting there.
We just started formulating a business plan, and we started thinking about, you know, we get to start from scratch here in a lot of ways.
Erica, who'll be the editor of the new publication, isn't interested in creating the Missoula Independent 2.0.
We actually have a couple of advantages. One is we're not totally starting from scratch because we have an audience built in, and we have we know what the need is, but we also can start over with a different model, and that was really exciting to us. So we're kind of doing that. We're just exploring what the possibilities are and not, you know, looking at things in the sort of narrow view of, you know, it has to be the same paper as it was before. It shouldn't be.
In Missoula, Montana, I'm Melissa Loveridge.
Still to come, we all have expectations that our doctor will act ethically. But how about the healthcare professionals that we don't see face to face? That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, any place. This This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Learning and maintaining high ethical standards is something we expect in professionals, but perhaps mostly in the field of medicine. Although biomedical ethics is a relatively new field, there have been discussions of moral issues in medicine since the time of Hippocrates. Over 2,000 years later, new physicians still swear by the Hippocratic or a similar oath. A review paper that appeared in the December 2019 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry provides a broad overview of ethics as it pertains to laboratory medicine. The authors of that paper are Dr. Anne Granowski, a professor in the Department of Pathology and Immunology at the Washington University School of Medicine, Dr. Melissa Boutelier, a fellow also in the Department of Pathology and Immunology at the Washington University School of Medicine, and Dr. Sheldon Campbell, a professor in the Department of Laboratory Medicine at Yale School of Medicine. They're all here to discuss this review article, and I started by asking Dr. Granowski why they felt it was important to write this review and what they hope to accomplish.
Yeah, so laboratorians, like all medical professionals, must adhere to high ethical standards. However, because many laboratorians don't directly see or treat patients, I think we often forget that laboratorians have a fiduciary duty to act in the patient's best interest. For us, that means making sure that the testing that patients are having performed is in their best interest and does not harm them. Unfortunately, studies have shown that many clinical laboratory training programs don't teach medical ethics. This is a real oversight, in my opinion, and one that we need to work to correct. This review that we wrote is meant to serve as a broad foundation for the study of ethics within laboratory medicine. It doesn't go in depth into any single topic, but rather it provides a framework of biomedical ethics for laboratorians. Each one of the topics we cover could constitute, you know, its own review. But our manuscript gives examples of real-world cases. It provides published references that are specific to laboratory medicine. And it suggests resources that laboratorians can access when faced with difficult ethical issues.
Okay, well, Dr. Boutelier, can you explain for us the core principles of biomedical ethics?
Yes, most experts identify three, sometimes four, core principles of biomedical ethics. One of these principles is respect for persons. This means maintaining the autonomy of the person and treating people with respect and dignity. In addition, the idea that people with diminished autonomy are entitled to protection. The second core principle is beneficence, which refers to the concept of doing good. In other words, the duty to act in the best interests of patients or research subjects. The opposite of this term is maleficence, and describes a practice which opposes the welfare of a person. Non-maleficence means to do no harm. Some experts break non-maleficence out as a fourth principle of bioethics because doing good and doing no harm are two different concepts. For the purposes of our review, we group them together. And finally, the third principle is justice, the duty or obligation to treat people equally and to distribute what is rightly due in terms of benefits, risks, and cost. In practice, the application of these principles includes the use of informed consent, the assessment of risks and benefits, and the fair and equitable treatment and allocation of resources. These principles can be applied to both medical research and medical practice.
And Dr. Granowski, what are some of the ethical issues that laboratorians face, and what, in your opinion, is the most challenging?
Well, some examples of ethical issues that are of particular interest to laboratorians include, for instance, the use of leftover specimens, incidental findings, genetic testing, and biobanking, just to name a few. In my opinion, one of the most challenging ethical dilemmas occurs when patients refuse treatment or testing that health providers believe are necessary. This causes a conflict between the healthcare provider's obligation to beneficence, but it opposes the patient's right to autonomy. This happens, for instance, when patients refuse inpatient drug testing for fear of the negative implications that might occur to their job or to health insurance, or when patients decline blood products due to, for instance, religious beliefs. Healthcare providers can override patient autonomy, but justifying the actions that violate ethical principles requires really careful consideration of whether the proposed action, one, is likely to achieve the underlying goal, two, that it presents the lowest degree of infringement, three, that it minimizes any negative consequences, four, it has no morally preferable options, and five, finally, that it was arrived at through the proper process. This usually is a group effort, including a healthcare team, risk management, or an ethics committee. These kinds of decisions are taken very seriously and can be extremely difficult.
I'm sure they are. Now, Dr. Boutelier, your review included a section on lab utilization. Can you explain how this is an ethical issue?
I'm glad you asked about this. Although most laboratorians rarely interact with their patients, they are still ethically bound to provide health care that is in the best interest of the patient. This is consistent with a core ethical principle of beneficence. Therefore, laboratorians should advocate for proper test utilization and communicate with physicians when they feel testing has been ordered inappropriately in order to do good and do no harm. As this audience knows, inappropriate laboratory testing can lead to additional discomfort for the patient or false positive results, which can lead to unnecessary testing and intervention or even misdiagnosis, as well as increased costs for the patient and society as a whole. As stewards of healthcare resources, laboratory professionals should be particularly aware of the medical practices that pose conflict between the interests of patient and society, and medical practices that have no or undetermined value. Improving lab utilization should be considered a fundamental part of a laboratorian's professional and ethical duties.
So, Dr. Campbell, let's go to you now. Your focus has been on outbreaks of dangerous and highly contagious diseases, such as Ebola, and the ethical issues that arrive when we have to balance the risk to laboratorians versus the benefits to patients. Can you talk a little about this balance?
Yes, of course. This is a place where we have to balance complicated and frequently poorly defined risks against one another. On one hand, laboratory testing is essential to the care of each individual patient. During the Ebola outbreak, many laboratories wouldn't accept samples from patients until they were ruled out for Ebola, which took hours to days. Ebola symptoms overlap with many other infectious diseases and some non-infectious diseases, some of which can be emergencies. In the best documented cases, appropriate diagnosis and treatment of malaria was delayed. At least one patient died, though it's impossible to establish that the delay was responsible. Additionally, the risk of any particular patient having Ebola was small. There were nearly 30,000 suspected cases in the entire outbreak, and that's probably an underestimate. But there are over a million cases of malaria in Liberia alone each year. On the other hand, laboratory workers deserve to be protected from excessive risk. How great is the risk of handling a sample from an infected patient in a modern laboratory? We don't really know. If a laboratory were to become contaminated and unusable, what impact would that have on the care of hundreds and maybe thousands of patients? Unfortunately, during that outbreak, many laboratories, under the banner of such phrases as an abundance of caution, simply failed to address the need to address these challenging questions.
Well, finally, Dr. Campbell, what would help laboratories prepare for and manage the next pandemic?
We do know that there will be a next pandemic. The combination of microbial diversity and adaptability, climate change, and globalization makes it nearly inevitable. The laboratory profession needs to discuss these issues more proactively in advance of the next event and create tools for addressing moral risk as we have for assessing quality and safety risks. The resources to build robust safety programs wouldn't hurt either. But when the next outbreak occurs, we're going to have to adjust in real time. We'll desperately need consistent messaging from public health and professional organizations and as much information on the disease itself, routes of transmission, virulence, persistence, and all the other parameters that impact risk as possible. Finally, laboratories need to create policies on how they will balance patient, worker, and systemic public health type risks.
Dr. Sheldon Campbell is a professor in the Department of Laboratory Medicine at Yale School of Medicine. Dr. Ann Granowski is a professor in the Department of Pathology and Immunology at Washington University School of Medicine. And Dr. Melissa Boutelier is a fellow also in the Department of Pathology and Immunology at the Washington University School of Medicine. Their review article entitled Ethics in Laboratory Medicine appeared in the December 2019 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. When it comes to how long your dog's life will be, size matters. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Small dogs outlive bigger dogs. Why? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Anna Jimenez, assistant professor of biology at Colgate University, explores this question.
Among species, larger animals tend to live longer than smaller ones. However, the opposite seems to be true for dogs. Smaller dogs tend to live significantly longer than larger dogs across all breeds. In my lab, we were interested in the mechanism that may allow for small breeds to age more slowly compared with large breeds in the context of cellular metabolism and oxidative stress. We wanted to look at normal aerobic respiration in cells and its byproducts termed reactive species, which are molecules responsible for oxidative damage, a process that can potentially attack DNA, proteins, and lipids, ultimately leading to decreased lifespans in larger dogs. In order to test this theory, we grew skin primary fibroblast cells in the lab from small and large breed dogs, both young and old. In those cells, we measured oxygen consumption rates and glycolysis, which are pathways via which cells make energy. We also measured a number of additional antioxidant enzymes and quantified damage accumulated in lipids and DNA. Our data suggests that rates of glycolysis were significantly higher in larger breeds across their whole lifespan compared with smaller breeds. Many cell types that are or become cancerous are often associated with this glycolytic activity. This may suggest that cells from larger breeds may be metabolically predisposed to tumor creation. We also found a negative correlation between DNA damage in puppies and mean breed lifespan, implying that smaller, longer-lived dogs may have a cellular mechanism to accrue less oxidative damage to DNA. Thus, large breed dogs may have higher glycolytic rates and DNA damage to blame for their decreased lifespans compared with smaller breed dogs.
That was Anna Jimenez of Colgate University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. Thank you.